Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello. Hello you. Have you got some kind of soft focus on your webcam this week?
You know, just for you, I thought I'd slip into something more ambient.
You've been rubbing Vaseline on the lens.
It's special. We're recording late at night, so it's a nice thing for you.
Well, thank you very much.
I didn't want a harsh light.
It's not unappreciated.
Oh, good.
Can I ask you about a dilemma? Marital dilemma.
Yes.
So at the weekend, we went to a farm, and not one of the ones where you're confronted with the pre-slaughterhouse nature of things.
I think Gene is a bit young for that.
Exactly. It's one of the ones where animals live a life of quiet dignity whilst being gawped at by children. So we don't drive. And to get there, it involved a train journey of about half an hour.
Yes.
And then a lovely 35-minute walk through a nature reserve.
Yes.
And then about 5 minutes along a B road, and then a little lane down to the farm. Does any part of that walk sound problematic to you?
The B road.
Oh, it does. Because my wife seemed to think it was very irresponsible of me to take our little family walking along a country road with no pavement whilst articulated lorries came hurtling around bends. But I thought people did that on B roads.
Oh, no, it didn't. Sorry, I mean, when you said problematic, that was just the obvious thing that didn't sound very quiet.
Right. But do you think it's a strange thing to do? Because I think it is not contravening the highway code as long as you face the oncoming traffic.
Do I really want to adjudicate on this? You think there's no chance that Sarah's going to be listening?
No chance in the world.
Right, okay. I feel like if the boot had been on the other foot, you might also have complained.
But I wouldn't have suggested that there was anything inherently at fault about walking on a country road.
Isn't it just the thing is, I think maybe sometimes these things are just a product of irritation. Don't you think? She probably just was thinking, oh God, I wish we could get there. It just feels quite long. And now there's like articulated lorries.
There was one point at which she had her son in front of her, not like a human shield, but she was shielding him by putting her arms across him.
Yeah.
And I thought, if something did come hurtling into us, I'm not sure that would be the barrier that you think it might be.
So basically she irritated you because you thought she was just being melodramatic.
And I'll tell you what else I thought. Americans, they can't conceive of car-free life.
So you then took it to a sort of national stereotype, as I notice. Your response to being kind of potentially in the wrong, I'm not saying you were in the wrong, was then to sort of cast a whole stereotype about Americans.
But come on, when you're out and about in Doncaster North, sometimes you're on a country lane. Do you not see a friendly hiker every now and again?
I mean, Justine and I did go for this bike ride in the countryside a few weeks ago. And it was quite a busy road, although she didn't complain about the busy road. She complained about the fact that the bike ride was far too long and much longer than I had. And I'd sort of said it was 10 kilometres to this coffee shop in the countryside, and it was 10 kilometres, but I took her on the sort of round trip, which took 28 kilometres in all.
Oh, so it was 10 kilometres as the crow flies?
Well, no, it would have been 10 kilometres there and back, but I went on the round trip, so I added a third to the journey.
Still struggling with your calculations a bit there. This is like one of those things where it turns out that an 18-inch pizza is more pizza surface area than 2 12-inch.
Have I just got the maths wrong here? What's your point here?
I don't know. It's making my head spin. Was it worth it, though?
It was actually quite a nice bike ride.
But the cafe...
Yeah, it was nice, really nice. The cafe actually cheered Justine up.
Uh-huh. The cafe at the farm had the opposite effect on Sarah.
But then, of course, there is the psychology of having to do it all over again.
Oh, we got a taxi.
Right, okay. How long did the bad mood last?
I wouldn't say it's over.
Oh, no, come on. Now, I think the time is near.
It is. We're loading up the van.
The roadies, is that right?
Yep.
The roadies are ready.
Yes, they are.
Travelling by train, of course. We are going to be at Stratford-upon-Avon on Saturday, June the 3rd, 2 p.m. at the Royal Shakespeare Theatre.
Yes, as part of RSC Live, which is a brilliant festival.
As part of RSC Live. It's going to be great. We're talking about climate education. We've got fantastic guests. It's just going to be really interesting and entertaining.
Yeah, and possibly our only live show this year, so please come along.
Possibly our only live show this year.
This week, we are getting down to business and talking about how lots of companies these days aren't about making a profit at any cost. We're inspired by the story of Patagonia declaring that the Earth is now our only shareholder. And we wanted to ask how effective this model is and whether others were also thinking along similar lines. We're going to be talking to Joanna Allen about some changes to UK law that would encourage more purposeful business. To Charles Conn from Patagonia, all about their new model to give all the profits to the planet. And to Jamal Ezel, the founder of Change Please, a social enterprise tackling homelessness through coffee. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful, it sort of applies to you as well. I know you don't like the humble brags, but this is not so much a humble brag as we can feel good that we did something good. So I met somebody last week whose name is Billy Knowles. Billy Knowles is the program director for something called the Youth Environmental Service. The Youth Environmental Service is something that Billy Knowles set up because he listened to our podcast.
Oh, wow.
And heard about the idea, and 90-something young people are doing good environmental service things all around the country.
That's fantastic. We've got a legacy.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, I'm chuffed about that.
And Billy's offered me the opportunity to meet the young people. And if you play your cards right and you don't say that I'm in Loserville, bracket C, last week's episode,
oh, no.
then you might get invited along. So there you go. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah, that's brilliant. I love that.
And I think we should give credit, I think, to Martin Moore, who was the guest who talked about it on our programme.
No, I don't want to be sharing the credit with Martin Moore.
Well, he doesn't get to come along to meet the young people, but
okay,
he just gets some credit.
Okay.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
We are going to have a Yes Day. So Jean was watching some film the other day called Yes Day, where the kids are fed up of being told no by their parents. So the parents agree to a yes day. I think there are certain caveats.
Do they involve walking on B roads?
But I'm quite excited.
So what does that mean? You have to say yes to everything he asks?
Yes.
What's his side of the bargain?
Well, I've told him it can't involve a lot of travel and it can't involve buying things. You think that's too restrictive, don't you?
No, I think it would be interesting. I think, doesn't he get like 10 yeses or something? I mean, is he unlimited?
Unlimited yeses on yes day.
Wow, amazing. I look forward to hearing how yesterday goes. Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So to start the conversation, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Joanna Allen, who is CEO of Grays, a snack company, and a registered B Corp. Thanks so much for joining us, Joanna.
Thank you, Ed, for having me.
First of all, how did you get into Grays? Talk to us about the story of it.
So Grays was founded back in 2008, originally a direct-to-consumer business, and then it exploded onto the retail scene in 2015. And in 2019, Unilever, a business broadly recognised for being a very kind of purpose-driven organisation, acquired the Grays business. And I joined the business a year after the acquisition. I had been in Unilever's core business prior to that, and I joined what is now 3 years ago to take Grays on its onward journey.
And what was your background before that?
Prior to that, I had always been a marketeer and had spent my career through Coca-Cola, both in the UK and in the US. And then, as I said, had joined Unilever to run originally their Hellmann's business globally. And then I moved into their personal care division. And I guess the experiences that I have brought into Grays is really that experience of running a business that is still scaling up and is scaling across multiple channels in terms of how we go to market. Grays is best known for its direct-to-consumer box, as I said, how the business started, but now has very broad distribution, and we're also starting to expand the business internationally as well.
And I said at the outset that Grays is a B Corp.
What makes it a B Corp? B Corp is something we talked about in an episode back in 2020, but what got you that kind of certification?
Yeah, so for anyone who maybe isn't so familiar, B Corp is an external accreditation that recognises that you're a business that holds yourself to a higher standard, particularly around your contribution, not just from profit, but also from your impact on society and on planet. And Grays has always been, it's always existed to bring more nutritious, tasty snacks to a market which is dominated by, frankly, let's face it, some pretty unhealthy choices. And so B Corp and securing that accreditation was really recognition that actually we're very much a purpose-driven business. We have getting people to eat more nutritiously at the very core of what we do. But B Corp assesses you not just on that aspect of your business, but also how do you treat your workers? What do you manage your environmental footprint as? What's your legal governance? And it's because of that, actually, that we became also supporters of the Better Business Act.
And we'll come on to the Better Business Act in a minute. Just on the B Corp certification, you said how you treat your workers. Does that mean you have to pay the living wage? What's the sort of requirement for that?
Yeah, so Grays is a living wage accredited employer, which means that we pay what we believe and what the Living Wage Foundation believes is a living wage that's appropriate for people to be sustained on. It's higher than the minimum wage. And as a business that runs quite a large manufacturing operation, we believe that that was really important to ensure that all of our workers were able to be operating on a sustaining wage. But it's also things like the fact that we have maternity and paternity policies. We support individuals going through IVF or dealing with miscarriages. We give our employees the opportunity to have a day every year volunteering because we recognise that it's really important that we contribute within our community. So you can be judged a B Corp on many different aspects, but those would be the most important ones to us as we think about our workers, our employees.
It is an interesting question about B Corp because there's been some criticism recently, for example, that there's some smaller producers, I think, criticised Nespresso's certification as a B Corp. Without getting into, I'm not asking you to sort of answer for a particular company that's not yours, but how do you think about the sort of balance between making the sort of B Corp brand so kind of broad enough that it kind of includes a kind of sufficient number of companies to be a kind of proper movement, but being so broad that anyone can get into it?
Absolutely. I think anyone who has become a B Corp has really appreciated the rigour of the B Corp assessment. And it is demanding and there is an enormous amount of effort that businesses put into securing that accreditation. And I think as soon as you've become a B Corp, you respect that level of rigour. I recognise that for B Corp to really shift how business is done, that has to happen at scale. And what is particularly important is that doesn't only happen with a kind of a more narrow profile of business, but has businesses that also encompass a broad manufacturing footprint. Because if we want to have the impact that we want to have around climate impact, climate change, you know, you have got to have the businesses involved that are manufacturing at scale and having that most material impact. So I am a believer, I'm an advocate for B Corp becoming broader. I know there are individuals within the community who challenge that. But I think if we want to see the scale of change that we must have, actually scale is an important aspect of how B Corp must move forward.
How do you go broad without compromising the standard?
Yeah, so B Lab, which is the kind of the organisation that drives B Corp forward, is looking at the standards and actually they are evolving. Today, there are the five pillars of B Corp and you might be amazing at something and maybe slightly less proficient at another area. And as long as you meet the threshold of 80 points, you become a B Corp. The future standards are saying actually there needs to be a kind of foundational level across all of the pillars. And then you might be, you know, then exceptional, best in the world for one particular area. But they recognise that as a B Corp community, we want to continue to make sure that those standards are being raised. And that's one of the drivers of the new standards for becoming a B Corp in the future. And I think it's important to remember, right, once you become a B Corp, you still have to recertify every 3 years. It's not that you get that badge and that's it for forever.
Now, the very fact that we're talking about this is perhaps significant in itself. I mean, what do you think about the shift in business that is going on towards this more purpose-driven way of doing business, and we'll obviously come on to the Better Business Act in a moment.
I think it's much needed, and perhaps obviously I'm biased and I'm a big supporter of it. When we look at the crises that we are confronted by, the climate crisis, the obesity crisis, the cost of living crisis, I think it is crucial that business plays a role in addressing those issues of the day. But I think also importantly, you see a growing number of the public who also have an expectation that business will play their role. 77% of people now say that businesses should have a legal responsibility towards people and planet, and that is only growing. So I think, you know, people demand it, the crises that we're confronted by requires it. And importantly, if you look at the businesses that are performing, the businesses that are securing investment, they are typically now the businesses that are purposeful. So I really believe that for British business to be on the front foot of securing that investment, attracting amazing talent, driving the highest levels of growth, we must do that with a broader set of stakeholders that we consider.
Is B Corp mainly about corporate reputation at the moment, or does it get you more customers, do you think? I mean, presumably it's not yet well known enough that it gets you people say, I'm going to buy from this place because they're a B Corp.
Certainly, we would recognise, right? B Corp is not as well known as some things like maybe Rainforest Alliance is a good example, or Fairtrade. It is growing. And I think for those consumers who are really engaged in understanding what the impact is that they're having from their consumption of things, it's an important reference point. But I think it then enables us to have great quality conversations across our supplier base, our customer base, and particularly as we attract talent, right? Being a B Corp is one of the top three reasons that Greys attracts brilliant talent into our business, particularly younger generations, right? They want to be working for a sustainable or purpose-driven business. And so for me, it is a brilliant asset attracting the very best talent to come and work for our business.
Now then, let's talk about the Better Business Act, because this is about a change in the law, which the supporters of the Better Business Act are trying to bring about. Do you want to just explain it to our listeners?
Absolutely. So we are seeking, as the Better Business Act Coalition, an amendment to Section 172 of the Companies Act. And so what does that mean? So today there is a fiduciary duty for a company director to put shareholder return ahead of all other areas of responsible business. And we believe that that is outdated. We believe it is important for company directors to have the responsibility to consider shareholder return and advancing that alongside the impact that a business will have on society and on the environment. And so amending Section 172 would recognise that only managing a business for profit return is no longer the most appropriate way for business, can often be quite short term. We believe that it needs to be a default change that all businesses adhere to, not just the businesses that are already kind of in the leading front of driving sustainable business like many of the B Corps are.
And I think we featured this a few years back, the Better Business Act idea. How much momentum has it gained in the business community, would you say?
Yeah, so we have a coalition of over 2,000 British businesses who have supported the coalition, who are backing that change. And what I think is really compelling is that it is at a complete cross-section. You have local firms, you've got Britain's best loved brands, you've got publicly listed companies who are backing that, and across all aspects of kind of British industry. So over 2,000 companies are calling for this, and that is only growing in terms of momentum.
And just so our listeners understand it, and you've explained it really well, but what do you think difference do you think it would make in practice for companies in their day-to-day decision-making?
So I believe it's about making sure that as responsible leaders of our businesses, that we are considering planet and societal impact alongside profit. It's that thoughtfulness of, is this a choice that I want to make because actually that will deliver a profitable return. But is there a way that I can do that that actually limits the negative environmental impact or actually provides a positive societal impact? It's about raising that awareness of considering multiple stakeholders rather than simply the profit return that you might get as we run our business. And I think that's a really powerful shift for British business to be on the front foot of.
Now, in a way, we're talking about the movement for this kind of change. I think it's fair to say that in the last year or two, there's also been a sort of movement against it. We've seen a sort of, particularly in the United States, a kind of whole casting of doubt on the whole ESG principles, you know, that this is sort of not really the right sort of capitalism and all that. I mean, where do you assess that sort of backlash and how do you think it's best countered?
So I think one of the benefits of what we're proposing with the Better Business Act is the fact that it becomes a by default change. Because there are some that would argue that, well, this is the natural evolution, right? If your argument for this is that businesses that are purposeful are growing ahead of the rest of the market, are securing investment ahead of the market, then by nature, evolution will mean that that becomes more of the market. And that's right, but we are confronted by a climate crisis, an obesity crisis, a cost of living crisis. And I believe that means that we should move at pace. We should go faster. Now, is there an opportunity for us to have more consistent ESG reporting? Absolutely. And I think many within the B Corp and the BBA coalition would welcome that from British businesses so that there is that more consistent playing field. But I don't think the absence of that should stop us making this sort of aspect of progress.
And the American revolt against ESG principles, you know, I think pressure's been put on different American firms about ESG. It's become a sort of party political dividing line in the US between the Republicans and Democrats. That doesn't seem to be happening here in the same way, does it?
No, and I think the BBA has got cross-party support, which I think is really positive. It recognises that it's not a kind of politically driven shift that we're trying to make. Now, ultimately, I still think, you know, it is fair that when greenwashing is perceived, it should be challenged. I think that's a really positive conversation for us to be having within industry. But I don't believe that the BBA is seeking to condone that. I believe it will, again, continue just to drive that conversation forward. But, you know, that's a healthy debate for us to have, for sure.
And where would you assess the public is on all of this?
As I mentioned, you know, you're seeing a vast majority of the public saying we recognise that business has to play a role. I think whether it's that or we saw another great report from the Edelman Trust Barometer, which recognises actually that there is great trust in business to do the right thing. There is desire for business to be involved. You know, I think these challenges that we're confronted by are too big for any one element of society to confront, right? I think it has to be a collaborative effort. Business absolutely should play its role. You know, we are the primary employer of great talent within the UK. And actually for us to be succeeding by driving a positive impact for our people, for society, for the environment, should be something that's endorsed.
Let me ask you a sort of more personal question. So people will have seen your product, I'm pretty sure, in the shops and so on. Just to sort of connect it back to you, what's the hardest thing about your job?
You know, Grays is, we exist to make snacking a positive choice. And I think if I think about just my business, you know, you might walk into a supermarket or into a petrol station, and often you are confronted by an array of choices which are anything but good nutrition. And so continuing to challenge, how do we make this a really positive choice for shoppers? How do we make it a choice that is compelling for retailers to also back, because they're backing the businesses that are helping them win as well? You know, that is a long-term journey that we're on at Grays, and every day gives us an opportunity to remind people that you don't have to make a compromise between really nutritious products that you can snack on and then something that feels tasty and indulgence. That's a good challenge for us to walk into.
In the absence of Jeff, who generally pokes fun at my business ideas, let me try something on you. So I really agree with you about the sort of problem of kind of the unhealthy snacks problem. My big beef is, if beef is the right word, is about the machines, the confectionery machines, because the confectionery machines always have really, really unhealthy stuff in them. And I have tried on various people, could we have fresh fruit machines? What's to be, because these machines are everywhere. Hospital.
You're meaning like vending machines?
Yeah. Hospitals, railway stations, goodness knows where. Now, I've tried this healthy fruit, vegetables machine on various people who've just guffawed and said it was sort of, it's a complete non-starter and, you know, the bananas would go rotten and goodness knows what. give me your kind of, you know, high, I want some high level response. Don't feel you've got to be polite to me here.
So I completely agree. And the aspect of vending machines often have the very worst of our industry's offering to consumers. I think there is a great challenge in what you're presenting of how do you offer great nutrition, but then the complement to it is how do you end up not creating a load of food waste, right? Because that's also a challenge. But there are plenty of businesses who are offering good nutrition, you know, brands that are really valuable peers to Grays, alongside Grays, where we can challenge that convention of, you know, poor nutrition, but without creating an issue around food waste because you're going to have a banana that goes brown in a vending machine.
I am right, aren't I, that the vending machine thing is totally uncracked problem. I mean, you know, you can find healthier snacks in shops now, but the vending machines, it's much more limited choice.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, snacking is it's an impulse business, right? You don't plan your snacks for the day, or there aren't very many people who do. It's something that you have an impulsive desire for, and you want to go and meet that need, right? And so that means that actually great nutritious snacks should be as available as all of the rubbish that's out there. And that's one of the sort of mandates I give my commercial team, which is, you know, for every place that there's a crap snack, I want a Graze as well, because you should be giving consumers the opportunity to make that choice as opposed to only presenting them with something that's poor from a nutritional perspective. And then you end up fulfilling that need, but with a really poor choice.
And just because our listeners might be wondering this, how do you make sure that what you're selling does meet the nutritious standard? You know, what's your way of achieving that?
Absolutely. So we have set a threshold. Every single Grey snack must offer a nutritional benefit and a meaningful one. So actually, like, one of the best example is, you know, across the British population, most of us don't eat enough fibre. But often when we think about fibre, we think about things that don't feel tasty and nutritious. So we have a product called Oat Boosts. All of those offer great fibre for people. So again, it's about good choices, good nutrition, and that's a threshold that we put on all of our products. All of our products are vegetarian, over 50% are vegan. They're all giving you really great variety in terms of nuts, seeds, whole grains, you know, all of the things that we probably don't get enough of. And that has always been in Grays' DNA. And even with the recent HFSS legislation around, you know, high fat, salt and sugar products, you know, all of our retail range has been designed to be compliant to that, so that, you know, again, for retailers, as they're thinking about how do I put, you know, good nutritious snacks in front of people and don't just present them with more chocolate, more confectionery, more crisps, you know, that actually range shouldn't be the reason why they can't do that.
Last question from me, Joanna. You talked eloquently about the Better Business Act. How can our listeners get involved and support that if they like the sound of it?
Absolutely. So just search the Better Business Act and you'll find our website. And within that, that's got all of the information that you might need to join the coalition if you lead your own business. Or if you don't, then go and hound the person who does, give them the information and then get involved. There's plenty of events. We would also encourage all of your listeners to write to their MPs to encourage them also to understand more about the Better Business Act as well.
Well, look, Joanna, it's been really great to talk to you. Thank you for not being too rude about my vending machine idea. And thanks for sparing the time.
Absolute pleasure.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So let's talk to Charles Conn, who is the board chair of Patagonia and joins us now. Charles, thanks so much for joining us.
Ed, it's great to be here.
Just before we get into Patagonia as a company, tell us about your involvement in Patagonia. How did you get involved? How did you become the board chair? Which sounds like a very good gig, don't you think, Jeff?
Yeah, chairman of the board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I bet he gets some nice merch as the chairman of the board.
That's the truth. No, that is the truth.
You're in it for the merch.
The good swag, as we say.
Yeah.
I met Yvonne many years ago, believe it or not, fishing in British Columbia. We had a common friend who's now gone.
This is Yvonne
Chouinard,
who is the founder of Patagonia.
That's right. Now 50 years of Patagonia this year.
Wow. Fact,
yeah. We became friends, mostly through fishing and conservation interests, and then I joined the board quite a long time ago now. And yes, it is a fantastic title, but I think it's really just because Yvonne didn't want to do it anymore.
Tell us a bit about the ethos of Patagonia as a company.
Yeah, I mean, for a very, very long time, the ethos of the company has been about conservation and about respect for nature. I mean, you know, the company is based in outdoor goods, and I think starting all the way back in the 70s, Yvonne realized that pitons, which was the original business of the company, which are the protection you put in rocks when you're rock climbing, were damaging the rock. Uh-huh. And so they led that first revolution, which was to design protections for rock climbers that didn't damage the rock. And then over time, the consciousness of Yvonne and his family grew, and the company became more and more about conservation. So for a long time, the mission of the company has been to make the best gear, do the least harm, and use the power of business to fight the environmental crisis. Back in 2018, Yvonne changed all that, and he said, now we're in business to save the home planet. And that gives you a little bit of a sense for the ethos of the place. It's like an activist organization that it also makes great gear.
And what does that look like in practice? So Patagonia has always donated 1% of sales to environmental and conservation work. It's a step up from that.
Yeah, that's right. Since the 80s, Yvonne started that with a friend, that program 1%. Now 5,000 organizations are part of 1%. And it's made a big commitment over time. And the family has as well. And I think this was the idea here was if our mission is to be in business to save the home planet, how can we take that to the next level?
And the next level is, I've got the quote here, Earth is our only shareholder.
That's right.
So talk us through that a little.
Yeah, well, you know, over the course of the last couple of years, Yvonne asked us on the board, how do we plan for when I'm gone? What's the next step for a company like us? And of course, we looked at all the things that people look at and investment bankers would tell you to look at. Should we go public and keep controlling interest and then distribute the money? Should we take a big interest from private equity and use the money to fight climate change? There is two wonderful kids who are part of this. They also really wanted their dad to be the one who made the decision. And he said, look, there are two criteria. How do we make sure that Patagonia continues to be the activist and iconoclastic organization that it is? And how do we give much more money to fight the dual environmental crises of climate change and species eradication? And that's how we came up with this plan to donate all the shares to the planet.
And just explain what that means in practice.
Yeah. So all the shares have been transferred and are held by two groups. One group is called a perpetual purpose trust that has the voting shares that make sure that the mission of Patagonia stays true forever. And the second is in U.S. parlance, a C-4, which is a kind of charitable trust that can give away money and do activism at the same time. So essentially, all of the cash flows from Patagonia that aren't required to be reinvested in the business are now available to fight the environmental crisis.
But it's still for profit. It's not
The company is, yeah. But now the company's separate from the ownership. But the company remains a vigorous competitor. We wake up every morning wanting to beat the competitors, but remembering that the Earth is our shareholder.
And we're talking about a substantial sum of money each year then that will go to these environmental causes, yeah?
Yeah. Initially, that's $100 million US a year, which is a pretty good chunk of change. It would make us amongst the biggest environmental grant makers anywhere. And we hope over time, of course, that will grow.
And what will you be doing with that money?
The family has a number of conservation interests, and those really focus on saving the last great places, especially those that are big carbon sinks. So one of the first projects is one called Peninsula Mitre, which is the very tip of Argentinian Patagonia, Tierra del Fuego. There's a new park there of 700,000 acres of land and 500,000 acres of water, including huge kelp forests. So that's one of the first projects. Another one is the Viosa River in Albania. So free-flowing rivers is one of the great passions. And a third passion area would be regenerative agriculture. About two-thirds of the surface of the earth is used to grow things we eat or to grow things for things we eat. And of course, that's one of the major contributors.
Can I ask, as a chair, you must be meeting a lot of people in similar positions in different organizations, executives, investors, and so on. What is their reaction when you tell them about this shift in focus? Are they easily persuaded?
Yeah, well, I think it was a shock to everybody. You know, some billionaires had made the Bill Gates pledge, which is to give away half their money. Of course, what Yvonne said was half. I think we can do better. And so I think people were shocked initially. What I'm really excited to see is that a number of organizations have already followed the lead. So Michael Bloomberg, who has a much bigger fortune, in excess of $60 billion, has also pledged to give the entire flows from his company for his charitable foundation. So we hope this catches on. If we could create a new model of capitalism where the flows of capitalism are devoted to making the world a better place, that would be a good thing.
So talk to us, because there is a debate, isn't there, about the way clothes are produced, fast fashion and all of that. You're obviously still a for-profit company, as you said, and in a sense, you know, the more profit you generate, the more it's going to go to help the environment. Apart from the environmental, the philanthropy of giving away the profits, are there ways that you think about the way you produce things and all of that?
Of course, and we always have. I mean, the fashion and clothing in general accounts for about 7% of the contribution to climate change, so it's pretty substantial. And we're very much against the kind of fast fashion that you described. So from very early on, we've been trying to measure our footprint from each garment that we produce and then to reduce that footprint. So that could be in carbon terms. It could be in water terms. It could be in use of dangerous chemistries or virgin fibers, all of which we have moved away from over time to the point where we're out of almost everything. By 2025, we won't have any fiber that is not regenerative agriculture or recycled.
And there's obviously a big wider debate in the business community about ESG, about B Corps, and just about the sort of role of business. What is the precedent that you hope that the Patagonia approach sets?
Well, I should start by saying we're huge fans of the B Corp and Benefit Corporation idea. I mean, the idea that you can build into the charter of companies purposes other than just making money is really powerful and important because it sets companies the challenge of what are the goals that are other than making money and how do we take responsibility to the communities that we operate in every sense of the word. We think, of course, you can go much further. And we think companies need to have a purpose and they need to declare what that purpose is. And that purpose ought to include what they hope for their teams, for their staff, what they hope for the communities in which they operate, and what their commitments are to the planet. And we think it's really important that companies make that kind of a commitment.
Do you have companies which are in any way a template for where you want to be?
I wish there were more out there, to be honest with you, Jeff. I think there are many companies we admire, including some big companies. It's remarkable that a company the size of Unilever, which has been around for more than 100 years, is as good as it is. So we're especially impressed when big companies, and especially big companies that have public shareholders, have the courage to make these kinds of commitments.
Just to sort of be slightly more challenging, presumably the great advantage of Patagonia is it's got essentially one shareholder owner who has decided to make the Earth the shareholder owner.
the ownership structure of other companies is just very, very different. In the sort of fossil fuel business, your shareholders are saying we want profits from fossil fuels. So how do you think about that question, the kind of unique circumstances or unusual circumstances of Patagonia as compared to companies that have a more common ownership structure?
Sure. So because we have a single shareholder, we were able to go further than many companies. That doesn't mean you can't start down this path and do good things. MasterCard is a giant company that's 9% owned by a charitable foundation. That foundation gives away more than $1 billion a year doing really good things. So we can all start down this path. I think there are many fossil fuel companies that are beginning to take seriously how they move to net zero. And I think we need to push everybody in that direction. So I don't think this special case of a privately owned company that has a radical activist intent should stop other people from starting down this path.
What's the hardest thing about being the board chair? Obviously, about having to choose between the different merch offers that you have. But
it's swag, Ed.
Yeah, swag, sorry. What's the biggest challenge?
You know, I think this will sound funny, but waking up every day and trying to see every business decision through the lens of our new shareholder is a different mindset than I've ever approached business before. To see things through this new lens, which is what's the best decision on behalf of the planet, even around things like what's our current inventory and what's our balance between wholesale and retail and online, I think that's hard.
So is that like a stress test you apply to everything, like right the way down the chain?
Yeah.
Not just the profits you give away, in other words.
No, giving away money is really hard. And I think most people wouldn't think that until you actually have to do it. But no, the hardest thing is how do we run the business now? We've always tried to be a responsible company. But now, in a way, you've got the earth breathing down your neck or looking over your shoulder and asking, is that really the right call for us?
I mean, it's interesting because on this podcast, we've talked before, and I think Jeff and I are big fans of something the government of Wales introduced called the Future Generations Act.
Yes, that's exactly what I was just thinking about, yeah.
Which, you know, is in a way a version of what you're saying.
Yeah, and I love that idea. And I think, you know, and of course, when you guys talked about Rawls recently, you were talking partly about future generations because there's this sustainability element there. Capitalism is a terrible thing. It just happens to be better than the other ways of organizing economies so far. But while it generates incredible wealth and incredible innovation, it does a really lousy job with distribution and an even worse job at intergenerational distribution.
And as you think about Patagonia sort of going forward in the 5-year, 10-year view, what are your aspirations for it?
Yeah. So, you know, as a business, we hope to continue to make the best gear for outdoor pursuits and to encourage more and more people to be in nature. But what we hope is that our way of thinking about things, this future way of thinking about things, catches on. And so we published everything about what we did. We've published how the structure works. We hope that it catches on with other businesses and with other business owners so that we have a chance.
Can I just ask, there is a fleece that I used to see a lot around 1990. I'm seeing it all the time again now with these hipsters in East London. How did that happen?
What's amazing is all that stuff has come back around. So yeah. I hope you didn't throw yours away.
The weird thing is I didn't know they'd gone out of fashion.
Yeah, you should get out more.
Yeah, exactly. Jeff says that a lot, actually, John. Well, look, Charles, it's really important what you're doing. And we really, really are interested in the Patagonia model and what it does. So thanks so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you both.
All right. With us now is Jamal Azel. Hello, Jamal.
Hi there, Jeff. Hi, Ed.
Jamal is the founder of Change Please, which we're going to talk about imminently. But before we do, we just need to calm Ed down because you're getting very excited about all the coffee roasting kit in the background.
Jamal has a spectacular coffee roaster behind him, which he says can heat up to about 200 degrees centigrade.
Celsius.
Or Celsius, as Jeff
or anybody under the age of 90.
Jamal, go on, tell us about these coffee roasters. What do they do?
So we're a not-for-profit social enterprise, and we tackle homelessness through
coffee, and essentially roasting coffee, selling it to corporates, selling it in our retail sites across the country is a really key component of how we tackle homelessness and how we educate people to upskill them, to give them new opportunities and new jobs. And I'll explain more about that later. But the roasting kit I have behind me is a state-of-the-art Giessen coffee roaster, which we had to import, and it fit through our academy site by literally 2 millimeters. So we just squeezed it in, and it essentially roasts green coffee, which we import from Brazil, from Colombia, from Kenya, Peru, working with farms that are supporting socially disadvantaged farmers. So one in Peru that supports women who are victims of domestic abuse, another one in Tanzania that supports landmine victims, for example. And the coffee's imported. We roast the beans from green beans into what you traditionally know as coffee, which is your brown bean, which goes into your grinder and into your cup at the end of the day.
Well, it's a very exciting looking piece of kit.
It really is.
It looks like it could be in the engine room of a submarine. How do you take your coffee, Jamal?
Me, I have a flat white. I don't really tell many people this, so I'm telling you in a secret. We are in 8 countries supporting governments in different markets, and I set up ChangeFeeds at the age of 29, and I had only drunk one coffee in my lifetime before that.
How did the idea come about?
Yeah, so my parents are refugees and came to the UK from Cyprus
where?
During the war in 1976. The focus for them and for me as I was growing up was having kind of financial security. So they sacrificed a lot. I went to a good private school and ended up being a commodity broker. And at the age of 29, thinking I had my dream job, I actually had a midlife crisis, a breakdown. And my partner was traveling at the time around the world, and I was joining her in different countries. And one of those was in Vietnam. It was this 18-hour bus journey going from Ho Chi Minh City up through Vietnam. And this American traveller jumped onto the bus next to me. I pretended to be British, quite reserved, kept myself to myself. And anyway, we got chatting, and he said, look, if you're not happy with your job or your life, you should do the rocking chair test. So that's to imagine sitting in your rocking chair at the age of 90, looking back on your life, thinking, what have you achieved? What's your legacy on the world? Have you left the world in a better place? How are your children going to speak about you when you're not here? You know, what's this whole life thing been about? A few weeks later, we stumbled across this silent tea house in a city called Hoi An in Vietnam. And these ladies who, some were deaf, some were mute, they came together, created this beautiful space. And I left and I said, I'm going to set up a silent tea house in Clapham in London. And then 2 minutes later, I realised I don't like tea. I hate Clapham. I don't like silence. This is going to fail very, very quickly. So the idea for ChangeFeeds came very quickly. I knew I could, through my own investments in property, I knew I could find a way to provide housing for people who are homeless. The housing part, surprisingly, is actually the easier part. The challenge is how you make that sustainable. So rather than somebody who's homeless being reliant on benefits, on somebody else's support, how about finding a way where they have employment and they have their own self-worth, self-dignity, self-confidence, they're part of a team, they have purpose, and they sustain their own housing through the private rental sector, which we then support them into.
And was it that you wanted to launch a business that made a difference, a social enterprise, or did the homelessness come first? That was an issue that was important to you.
Yeah, great question. So we're not a coffee business that's trying to do good and on the side. We're a charity and a social, not for social enterprise set up to tackle homelessness through coffee, if you see the distinction. And some of the projects that we've launched since then, you might have seen on TV, these buses where we have dental services in partnership with a well-known dental company, providing dentist services to rough sleepers, because 15% of homeless people try to pull out their own teeth out of sheer pain. So it's really around using the revenue we generate from coffee profits, selling our coffee into airlines, into gyms, into corporates, into Downing Street, for example, that we generate the profits from that then goes back into lifting people out of homelessness.
And what did the people in your old job think?
Firstly, my parents thought I was crazy and begged me not to do it. And then part of my friends, actually, some of them were, you know, saying I should keep doing what I was doing, and some were completely understanding and really have now gone in to do similar things in the future. I mean, so the social enterprise economy in the UK is the envy of the world. I mean, we've had the UAE royal family come to the UK to see what we do, the Deputy Prime Minister of Thailand, and now it's such a key part of our UK economy.
Give me a sense of what you've managed to do then in terms of the number of people you've managed to help. How many homeless people are you helping? How many people are you employing?
So we support equivalent of 5% of the UK's rough sleeping population out of homelessness per year. And we're a tiny company.
Wow. That's phenomenal.
And it's just done through employment. So typically 700 to 800 people a year. And when we look at what lifting people out of homelessness looks like, it isn't just a bit of training here. We're looking at how can we sustainably, if somebody leaves us after 6 months, have they sustained employment and have they stayed out of homelessness? That's our key measure. You know, the other measure really is that 44% of people who are homeless want to work and can work. Our mission is to find that 44% and give them a way out of homelessness through jobs. So they're not waiting on a waiting list somewhere for a home or accommodation, but they're doing it through their own means.
And do you provide them with the housing, or how does that work?
Put yourself in the situation of someone who's been out on the streets for 2 to 8 years. We've now given them an opportunity and we're paying them a London living wage or a living wage anywhere in the country. So you've gone from earning nothing to £23,500 in London. So it's quite a big jump. So they need support in that journey, both mentally and managing that process. But within 10 days of them joining us and joining our team, we then support them into housing. The way that we do that is they will go to a landlord typically with our payslip and saying, I've now got employment, please provide me with accommodation. The landlord will say, well, where's your references? Where's your deposit? And where's your first month's rent? And they don't have any of that. So what we do is we know that that person is an employee of ours. We then directly approach the landlord and guarantee the rent directly to the landlord and then pay the landlord directly from that person's payslip. Typically after 6 months, that person has built up a track record of paying that rent through us directly to the landlord, and they are able to find accommodation anywhere else that they wanted if they wanted to leave. And the model really works. It's just fantastic to see how we've grown that from London to New York, Perth, and it really is a sustainable model of lifting people out of homelessness.
It's an incredible thing. I mean, it's just incredible hearing you talking about it. But I am wondering if you ever find it frustrating that you're picking up the slack on something that maybe the government should be addressing.
Over time, a very small part of me feels that way, and that's probably 1%. It's just exciting. The overriding feeling is excitement that you can take a problem which most governments tend to struggle with and look at it differently. And approach it differently, and it actually works. That's the overriding feeling. And I think the more we've developed as an organisation, we've started to be commissioned by local councils, by DWP, for example, and realising that actually the model that we have and we do a standard can be commissioned, which could then increase to a much larger level of impact. So that's the journey we're on at the moment. And I think it's partly just doing your part. Tackling social problems, I think, is exciting. And we tend to recruit a lot of people from the corporate world, and they join us with that excitement, you know, knowing that they can apply their commercial knowledge and expertise into something that's delivering social good. And that's the overriding feeling. It's using our knowledge from business to apply it into social impact.
What do you think is the wider lesson for businesses more generally, Jamal?
The power to be able to deliver social change through procurement spend is incredibly exciting. As I said before, we supply coffee into airlines, into government, into gym train networks. And by them, as long as the quality of the product, the price of the product and the convenience to purchase is as good as the non-impact alternative and the social impact is a bonus, then why not make that change? And we're seeing corporates all over the world, you know, I mean, I would just be mentioning household names who are converting their spend from everything from coffee to toilet paper to AV equipment to, you know, construction equipment with social businesses. And that's why really the UK is really leading the way in that charge. So really speaking to corporates and telling them that they have a responsibility to make that decision from the top down for their employees, for their customers, for society at large, is a real fast-track way for us to deliver social change.
Let me ask you a question, Jamal. My wife is constantly saying that she can't have coffee after 11 in the morning or she won't sleep that night. Now, I feel like when I was growing up, people were always drinking coffee of an evening and going out to a restaurant and having a cup of coffee after a meal or on a date. Has coffee changed?
Coffee hasn't changed, but actually, if anything, the level of caffeine in coffee that we drink today is actually slightly reduced.
So what is wrong with these people?
I mean, I'm one of those people, if I'm honest. If I drink coffee after 10 o'clock, I won't be sleeping at night.
I could have a double espresso and go to bed 20 minutes later.
Can I ask a more obscure question? Or not obscure, but more sort of nerdy question. What is the difference between a flat white and an Americano with milk?
So an Americano with milk has quite a lot of water. So you have your espresso. Both would have a base of espresso. An Americano will then be topped up with water and then a bit of milk, a splash of milk at the end. And then a flat white, however, is still that base of espresso with a larger amount of milk without any of the water. And then a level above that is a latte. And a level above that is a cappuccino. I'm geeking back at you, Ed. So.
You can never out-geek this, man.
No, I've been out-geeked. Jamal, it's been great to speak to you. It's really great what you're doing. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure's all mine. Thanks for having me.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
Whoa, ho, ho, we're in the outro, ho, ho. Now, I've got some news to report, which is fresh from my email exchange with Fuchsia Dunlop. I made hot and sour mushroom soup from her recipe book.
Oh, wow, that's a big favourite of mine.
And my wife really liked it.
What did she say exactly?
It was edible. No, she said, oh, I really like this.
Aha, then I think you're probably right then.
The children didn't like it, but it was not, it's not children's sort of thing.
No, they've got unsophisticated palates.
Yeah. Should we thank our guests and be nice to them?
We should.
I'd like to thank our guests, Joanna Allen, Charles Conn and Jamal Ezel.
Emma Corsham is our audio producer. Rachel Barmer is our content producer. Ably assisted and, in fact, deputised for.
Yes.
For some of this week's episode by Joe Kenyon at Goldfish.
Rachel Content is on holiday.
She is. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made our idents. Ed Seed composed the music. And our artwork was designed by
Henry Cole.
He's been Ed Miliband.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.